chocolate.
Oh, good.
I hear a chocolate sigh.
Some is desserts from the workshop out there.
Okay.
Yeah, two aren't here. Eileen's not here, and Mary Kay's in Italy.
Wasn't
there someone else? Lila. Lila's here, yeah. Yeah, she's not a regular member. She lives in North Carolina.
Oh, okay.
But she'll be glad to know you, mister.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Are you ready? We get up to page 11. Two main points, I think. The two definitions of projection. One, kind of commonsensical. Something in yourself you don't own, you see it outside yourself. It's thrown or projected outside yourself. And we don't we don't create the projections. The projections happen from the unconscious. That's one of the tricks involved. So you just find yourself in a certain experience, but that experience is created by the fact that the unconscious has painted the outer world in an image that recognizes, in an image of a face of yourself that you don't recognize. That's not so hard. The other one is a little more obscure, which is a disturbance in the archaic identity between subject and object. We'll be talking about that all along, so if it's fuzzy, don't worry. The idea is that the projected state is the original state of human consciousness, of humankind. So that this throwing out that I talked about is what we do from day one. And it's not that we make projections, it's that projections are made and we simply haven't withdrawn them. So the projected state is the normal quote-unquote state. That's what he's driving at there. And I think, you remember, electron can be a particle and a wave. They're a little bit contradictory, but because I think you can repress something and project it, and it hasn't always been projected. But these two definitions we'll be looking at all throughout the course. So don't worry if it's not totally clear. The other thing, which we will return to repeatedly, is the five. She calls it five steps in the withdrawal of projections. We'll go back to that again and again and again. So let me just review that. This is on pages 10 and 11 if you want to make a note. First, there is the identity with the projection. The identity with the world that the projection creates. So, you know, I had a mean father, and I see every man is mean. And what I don't realize is I'm mean too. The second step is the step of differentiation. I begin to realize, maybe everybody isn't mean. Or maybe that particular person isn't mean. And the third step is moral evaluation. That I realize that what I have seen is either helping me or hurting me, enhancing me or distracting me. That's the moral evaluation three. The fourth stage is where we'll spend a lot of time in the book, is when we begin to realize that projection is an illusion. Or you might say that projection is a projection. Now, for the personal stuff, you know, for the example I just gave you, it's not that critical in terms of its implications, but where we're going to make a great deal of that is in religious projections. And we'll see, what I think she does so beautifully is that science is just as full of projections as religion is. So, we now can see when the Greeks say that the water contains nymphs, we can say, well, there's no nymphs in water. That's a projection. And the danger, however, is then we say that nymphs don't exist. Well, they don't exist literally, but they do exist psychologically. So that leads to the fifth step, where what has been projected is seen as existed internally. It's what has been projected is seen as existing internally. So in my personal case, I'd say, well, I'm the guy who's a creep. I'm the mean person. And in the Greek analogy, I'd be saying, well, but the sprite is a function of my personality. There are sprites. There just aren't literal sprites in the outer world. There are subjective sprites inside myself. And then the last, she says it's the fifth step. I thought it was a little easier to break step five down into 5A or 5B or 5 and 6, that there's an integration. So it's one thing for me to say I have an inner sprite. It's another thing to say, what is that sprite asking me to do? It's one thing to say I have a mean inner father. It's another thing to say, and how do I transform that? And just in that little schema, we've opened up huge issues without even realizing it. I said that thing exists inside myself. But the problem is, suppose I have withdrawn a projection from God. Do I want to say God exists inside myself? Suppose I, remember the guy who, the example they gave of the guy who heard the spirit in the tree. Do I want to say that is only in me, or what? So it opens up another question. By answering the question of projection, it opens up another question. Is everything subjective, or is there a, I think the word she uses, is there a trans-subjective reality? In other words, it exists in the collective unconscious, not necessarily in my own personal unconscious. And then the question of, is there a metaphysical reality to those things that we once thought were divine? So that's why she's writing the book, to investigate some of those questions. So where does that thing ultimately lie is a question that comes up. Does that all sound familiar? And then we stopped on page 11. This fairy tale gives a good example of integration, but it also opens up another question. What's it mean to integrate? We'll see that some of the projected contents can be integrated into the ego, and some are integrated into the self. That is a huge distinction. Integrate into the ego would be my example, say, of the angry dad. Well, I can take control of my own aggression. I can own up to the fact that I'm a nasty person. I can own up to the fact that I use my aggression to hurt other people, and I can choose to stop blaming other people for that, and I can choose to use that aggression constructively. That would be integrating it into the ego. Suppose it's that tree spirit, or suppose it's the Water sprite, or suppose I, all the examples I gave, by the way, were negative, they can be positive. Suppose I project positive things onto a poet. Well, I just can't sit down and write a poem, but I find at certain moments I can be inspired to write a poem. See, that content is not something I've integrated into my ego. If it were my ego, I could control it. So some of the things that we integrate into the self, meaning I realize it's a part of me which I have to serve. And so the former I can control, and the latter I have to serve. It will never be something my ego can legislate. That's important for a couple of reasons. One being, if you think you are every projection you withdraw, you get inflated. Oh, I'm a great poet. Or if I admire Einstein, oh, I'm a great scientist. Rather than, there's a scientist in me who's asked me to do certain things, and I am at its mercy whether it gives me good ideas or not, so I need to develop an attitude of respect for that part of myself, not think I am that part of myself. All the stuff we'll be talking about, I'm just kind of summarizing some of the issues that come up. So we then, so let's start with a paragraph. What on 11? What is known as integration in modern psychology is thus a remarkable and complicated process, thank you very much, in which a hitherto unconscious psychic content is brought repeatedly into the view of the conscious ego and recognized as belonging to its own personality. In the process, this content is changed in its functioning and effects. Now that's integrating it into the ego. And then she gives a story. A young man had been called up for military service. Maybe we can summarize it. He goes to sleep. He sees an eerie woman with a rope in her hand sneaking away. He follows her, and she goes into the house of a poor peasant. In the house, a young woman, dissolved in tears, was sitting at the bedside of a small child. The ghost sat at the roof beam above her, dangling the rope in such a way that it keeps making the movements of a hanging. The young woman succumbed to the suggestion, climbed on a chair, and prepared to hang herself. The soldier broke in through the window, seized the rope, and warned the young woman, "Take good care of your child. We have only one life to lose." On his way back to the temple, the ghost appeared and demanded her rope, but the soldier wrapped it around his arm and tried to frighten the ghost away. The struggle followed. Inadvertently, the soldier struck his own nose with his fist, and blood flowed. Because the ghost cannot endure the sight of human blood, the ghost stopped fighting and disappeared. The soldier then went on his way to report for service. Later, the rope could be seen. Here's the crucial thing. The rope could be seen on the soldier's naked arm because it had grown onto the arm and surrounded it in the form of a ring of red flesh. Who wants to try to interpret that? Yeah, what would the rope and the woman symbolize if we take them as part of the main figure of the fairy tale? He's going off to war or to the army. And you could say his anima is in despair. Does that make sense? Why would she be in despair?
Because he could not
Yeah, because he's losing his chance of a normal life, at least for a while, and he could be killed. So she would personify his grief. So,
I'm sorry, the one with the rope, or the one with the child?
Well, they're the same. They're symbolically the same.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And the rope would be his own self-destructive tendencies, which we can assume he would be projecting onto somebody else. It could be onto a woman, it could be onto anybody. Here it sort of suggests it's a woman, but it wouldn't have to be only. And the tale shows that by fighting the battle of withdrawing the projection, he makes it his own capacity, as indicated by the rope in the arm. And his hitting his nose is another indication that he's really struggling with himself. And the blood would be the suffering that's involved.
So then the fact that it is on his, the rope is now on his arm, and that he has integrated his own self-destructive tendencies,
right,
and is more aware of them.
Yeah.
Okay.
And what we, I'm tempted to say universally find, is that when the thing is integrated, it loses its destructive power. In other words, you could say, well, what's so positive about a destructive power? Why would you want to make that your own? Well, if you need to stand against something else that's destructive, it would be your strength, knowing what destructiveness is and knowing how to fight it. Knowing how to destroy what's bad, for example.
Can I ask you, though, I mean, if he's going off to war, why would the rope have to be his self-destructive tendency in a way, you know, what he's going to be called to do? I mean, I kind of read this almost as a projection of his dread of having, or whatever the right word is, of having to go fight.
I think it is, in a way, his dread of having to go fight, but it leads him to a feeling of hopelessness.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what is overcome.
On the next part, it says, according to a prevalent, a belief prevalent in China, the spirits of women who have hanged themselves in grief over their unhappy lives cannot move on to the kingdom of the dead who they have brought about the suicide of another woman. I was thinking of it maybe as kind of a universal, not just his own private projection, but maybe that of a patriarchal society that is hurting women, and they believe that the ghosts, once a woman commits suicide, they believe that the ghosts of other women are causing her suicide without realizing it's their patriarchal society, those people that are alive, particularly maybe the men that are alive, that are creating the situation where the mess.
Well, I think you could say this is typical of a patriarchal society where the soul is destroyed. Yeah. In that sense, you could say it's a collective projection, and in that sense, it shows up in the tale that, where do we see that the ghost stopped fighting and disappeared, so that it really hasn't been fully integrated into the ego.
And just the fact that there's a war shows that there's a certain amount of still destructive impact.
Yeah. Well, she gets on to that point then, in the bottom of the last paragraph, the last full paragraph on 13. Or it may appear in another medium, see where I am? which now becomes the new bearer of the projection. One wants to prevent such a renewal of the projection. If one wants to prevent such a renewal of the projection, the content must be recognized as psychically real, though not part of the subject. See how she's changed her argument a little bit. She's just been talking about making the rope part of the guy. And here now she says, the real issue is realizing that it is not part of ourselves, but that it is an autonomous power.
It's both.
It's both.
I mean, one moment.
He's integrated a certain amount of it, but part of it yet remains unintegratable, probably always unintegratable, meaning you'd have to always be paying attention to that degree of negativity in yourself. In the first case, it goes away or it changes its form. In the second case, you just realize it's in yourself, but then you're left with the problem of constantly paying attention to it, watching its behavior, and I think, you know, I don't want to be Pollyannish, but 95% of the time, it will start giving you good advice, if you can pull that off. But you have to be able to recognize it and withstand its destructive effects. So here in these two pages, he presents the two ideas of what integration is. Into the arm, and then into the unconscious.
I couldn't help but thinking of those World War I movies where the guys were in the trenches and they would shoot their... They would shoot themselves so they could get to go home.
Yeah.
And that, you know, that level of despair and desperation, on the one hand, it is kind of giving in, but on the other hand, it's saying, this is not life. This isn't serving life either. And I need to go home and serve life. So, you know what I mean? It was so bad. I mean, it was so disgusting and bad and to live in those trenches. They couldn't practically take it.
Mm-hmm.
And I got into a big argument with my husband about it because he went to Vietnam and, you know, he said that was betraying the fellow brothers in the fight. But then I said, but it's also a level of despair. I don't think any of us can understand how bad that must have been, that you would shoot your own arm or leg or hand.
Or put your arm above the trench, so somebody on the other side would shoot it, and you couldn't be accused of aiming yourself.
Oh.
They did that too.
Yeah. But, I'm trying to relate it to this big time.
Well, it's the nature of evil. And you recognize it as an inner power.
I mean, because in a way, you're just being asked, you have to kill someone so you don't get killed. Which is, to me, was similar to, the ghost of the woman. You need to bring about someone else's suicide.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to kind of accept that.
Yeah.
Even or whatever in yourself.
And at the same time, with what Anne was saying, you know, that there is this, I mean, the fact that we even go to war and we force people into fighting like that, whereas, you know, like in Joel and Noel, I mean, they really didn't want to. None of these people wanted to. And so these governments get the people in situations and the patriarchal values continue that. I don't know, I guess it's just a lot of levels mixed together, but to me, I mean, some of that to me was somewhat healthy, that they got that desperate that they went ahead and do something to...
Well, it was certainly realizing that the enemy wasn't as bad as they thought it was, and that their situation was worse. That's part of integrating a projection.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
But it wasn't cowardly. I mean, in my estimation, it wasn't cowardly. Like this was, to me, it intimates if he hadn't fought, it would have been... giving in to despair.
Mm-hmm.
That in the trenches.
I don't think it's cowardly.
It's something different.
Mm-hmm.
don't know the term to give it, but I don't think it was giving.
Survival. The little image of the boat, did you follow that? Bottom of 13 over to the top of 14. The image is that we're all on a sailboat, and we have different sized boats, and withdrawing projection means putting more things in that boat. And the question is, how much can your boat hold before it sinks? The withdrawal of negative projections is demoralizing. You know, you think the world's creepy, and I'm the one who's creepy. The withdrawal of positive projections also can be demoralizing because you realize, I've got to do something about this gift of mine. And it's amazing how we protect ourselves against those realizations. So she's just giving us Jung's metaphor of a boat, and the withdrawal of projections is like putting new things in that boat. And then we always have to beware when we're talking to somebody. How much can that boat stand? That could be part of what's going on in your situation too, Jane, that I dare say, your husband still is projecting the enemy outside. And it'd be too much to withdraw the enemy inside, and could his boat hold it? Mm-hmm. It's really, you know, in the practical work, it's really important to watch how much can that person stand? How much of the truth of themselves can they stand? Because they simply sink in a demoralized state.
And yet, I guess, I can see it being a very... it being a survival thing to stick your hand up there, and I can see it as being even a brave thing because you're taking the injury on yourself so that you don't have to shoot the enemy mm-hmm. that you've now realized isn't as bad. And yet you are letting down those comrades and others. Mm-hmm. That is part of it too.
Mm-hmm.
So that, even though that is the opposite, it's still a truth.
Mm-hmm. Yes. A conflict of
conflict of duties.
Conflict of duties, definitely. Yeah.
Yeah, that's where I get. I mean, it is really a conflict. I mean,
it is like.
Yeah, so what good are you to your family if you come home dead?
Yeah, I mean, there's that too.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the fact that you exit the stage makes it worse for your mm-hmm. comrades.
Because they
have
to
stay and endure.
Well, even the fact that you do the war is so different than what we're all taught. I mean, it's like you're brought up to love and, you know, be good, and then they say, okay, go in there and kill me. I mean, it's like you have to change your whole way of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
You can't.
And the fact that 4 years later your husband still struggles with that shows what a huge psychic issue that was for the
And family. Now we're having Bob Dylan play the Vietnam. But they were horrible people. Now they're our friends. Look at the country.
Just the north, yes.
Oh, just the north, yes.
Now we're okay.
And now we're doing business with our country. See, the contradictions are just unbelievable.
Can we call projection a
conflict?
Is it a conflict?
No, I'd say a complex is projected.
Okay.
I think Jung would say, well, Freud would say, projection is the way we defend ourselves against knowing a complex. Jung completely flips that around and says, projections are the way we get to know our complexes. So for him, it's a natural, healthy process. The problem is when it gets stuck.
So could you say those two opposites are both true? We defend ourselves against...
I'm afraid they are both true, yeah. I'll give you an example. I remember the first time I worked with a very strong sexual feeling, transference and counter-transference. I'm not crazy about those words. Anyway, I talked about, and I couldn't do anything with this woman for quite a while. And I took it to one supervisor, and he said, well, you see, that sexual transference is her resistance against consciousness. I took it to another one. He said, you idiot, that's why she's coming. See what I mean? Both were true. I think the latter was, for me, the real truth. It's just that they're so overpowering that they, it's like they inhibit our efforts to understand what they mean. And then we've got to have superhuman strength to face them.
That's what's so neat about you. I was always looking for that nugget of gold.
Yeah.
In the ship.
And I think where you really see it, I don't know if we'll get into it in the book so much, but if you've paid attention to your projections over years, you'll see the situations they led you into. And really, I thought this was, in a way, one of the points of Darrell's work, that they're going to get you into nonsense, but that's part of following up a projection, going to what attracts you. Whether you're projecting or not, it doesn't matter. You're not going to find out what the projection is about unless you put yourself in that situation. And then if you are able to integrate what nonsense you have lived, you'll get into another situation and you'll integrate that. You'll get into another situation, you'll integrate that, and you'll see that it has actually led you through life. So that there's a secret symmetry beneath these apparent isolated events that link them together and are actually furthering your development. So in language we've used in other classes, the spirit is behind projections. The order that they occur shows an intelligence. It sure doesn't feel like it being in the middle of them, but when you've lived through it, a couple of them, and step back, you see they've actually gotten you somewhere. That's why Jung is so hesitant to say it's a defense only. But it is really the means by which consciousness is created and our own destiny is revealed. Because each projection will be expressing to you the next phase of your destined development. So you don't choose these projections. If you're totally naive, you may fall in love with a very conservative business person who counteracts your naivete. Okay, so you get a little more realistic, and then you fall in love with an artist because you have artistic capacities you haven't developed. And then you develop those. And then you may fall in love with another businessman who would be your ability to take your art out into the world. I mean, that's kind of a simplistic schema, but you see what I mean, how these projections are really the means by which the unconscious self makes itself conscious, one experience at a time. That our morality and our good sense, and even again, going back to Darrell, even psychology, I think, harms this, because we say, oh, that's my father complex, or, oh, that's this. The fact is, you want to be with that person, so shut up and go be with them. Yes, you'll make a mess, but you won't learn what you need to learn if you sit back on an Olympian tower. That's the subtext, I think, to this book, and why it's so very important. So you can't talk about the projections very long before you start talking about the self. And the projections are the way the self, one of the ways the self makes itself known. This would be the Gnostic idea of recollecting parts of yourself, and projection and recollection. What you're doing is you're recollecting yourself. It takes a lot of courage, strength, and a certain sense of humor. I think Darrell probably emphasized the humor aspect of it, but to not stay back from life because it's not always neat and clean. We used to blame the church. Now I think we can blame psychology sometimes. Okay. she goes into another fairy tale. Now, try to give you an overview before we do it. The first fairy tale presented the issue of what it is to integrate into ego. And then we saw an allusion to what it is to integrate something not into the ego. The fact that these things sometimes can't be made. Only factors that we can control. Now she gets into a fairy tale to discuss another point, and I have got to confess, I think it's confusing. And I have never understood why Jung discussed it the way he did. Let's at least look at it, and I'll try to explain my own confusion, which may or may not be right. Anyway, bottom of 14. A peasant. On his way to find a princess. Sees a corpse frozen in a block of ice. That is spit at by every passerby. The corpse was a wine dealer and had diluted his wine with water. And the pastor refused a Christian burial. He meets a traveling companion, and the companion offers to win him the beautiful princess, and he learns that that princess has been bewitched by a troll. After a bunch of hardships, the princess is won. Later, a year later, at the top of 15, the companion reveals that he is the dead wine dealer, and that was his way of rendering thanks. But now he must go away forever because the bells of heaven are calling. So the idea is, by feeling sympathy for that corpse, he effects his transformation. And then she gives another story of a dead man who is so poor that no one will bury him. And the hero offers his money for the man's birth, death. Good slip. Tongue. So the point of both that she'll follow up on is sympathy. We could just back up a second and notice how other people are projecting their shadow onto the wine dealer by spitting at him. That's not where she goes with a fairy tale, but that would be a fair way to go. What she does is analyze this business of sympathy in terms of projection. And here's where I get confused. She says sympathy is an act of lodging your imagination about yourself in somebody else. Or imagining you would be that person. Projecting your own existence onto that other person as a way of establishing sympathy. So it's like, if I were you, I would feel this way.
You know, mirror neurons speak to that whole thing. Mm-hmm. Because they've discovered that the brain actually has that physical response when it sees suffering in another person. It puts you there.
That's what we're talking about.
It's neurological.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And they can see that.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Don't you call that empathy, not sympathy?
Empathy, yeah. What does she sympathetic response. I think they're the same.
Okay. Some people do make a distinction.
Yeah.
Sympathy would be what, a little more pity.
Or empathy being more conscious, perhaps. I don't know. What do you think,
Andy? It'd be interesting. This is a translation. And I know in German the word for empathy is sympathisch. So I don't have the German here. what her German was. I don't even know if they make a distinction between sympathy and empathy.
I think empathy, you're more just feeling what they're feeling. Sympathy, you're kind of putting a judgment on it.
Yeah. What they're getting at basically is you're feeling what they're feeling. Yeah. So that you have projected your experience out onto the other person.
The way I hear empathy and sympathy, distinguishes, sympathy is where you become so one with that other person that you cannot stand outside, so you can't help. Whereas with empathy, you feel for them, but you're enough divided that you can help. And they make a big issue with that because of nursing burnout. And if you cannot divide yourself from your patients, you just...
Yeah, that's the conscious aspect.
Right, you just lose it. But if you can divide yourself from your patient enough to help your patient without becoming one with them, but also without cutting off, because you'll see a lot of nurses who are just, they have no empathy, sympathy, or anything else for anybody at some point, because they just cut that off.
They're defending against that feeling.
So, that's the way.
That's a good distinction. But what you said, I think, for our argument that's so important is you put yourself in somebody else's place. You see, that's a projection. Now, where I get confused is why they call that a passive projection. Don't know.
Maybe that's the mirror neuron idea.
Okay, go ahead.
If it's a passive projection, it's the function of your physiology, perhaps.
Hmm.
So it's not actively...
You may have solved my problem. It's a physiological reaction.
Mm-hmm. Or is an active projection perhaps has something to do with your own complexes?
That could very well be. Yes, thank you. I've worried about that for 35 years. I knew you were here for a reason.
I'm finished.
Where I also got confused with the term passive. I mean, he does something, though. He doesn't just,
That's what I thought.
Have this feeling. He then acts and gets all his money to have this idea.
That's what I thought. That was my thought process. Yeah. Well, I don't know if the words are that important. But just be aware that they see empathy as a projection. Which is interesting. I don't know where to go with it. But, if there's any quality of our society that is on the increase, it is the lack of empathy. It's astounding how cold people have become. And so what that says about projection, I don't know. But it's just, and she won't make much of this idea of what she's calling passive projection, but she just introduces it. And I wanted to touch on it.
Well, if projection is something we don't have control over, how can it be active or passive?
Well, that was my question. But I think what Carol says makes sense in a way that it's a physiological response. I have a wonderful video, which is actually quite depressing, of animals rescuing each other, not of the same species, different species. I may have mentioned a hippopotamus helping a crane stuck in mud get out. And did you see that? I don't know if you saw it in the news, the buck that was guarding a goose sitting on eggs. Apparently the male goose had gotten killed or wasn't around. And it was in a cemetery in New York, and there was a funeral urn, and the goose had made its nest and was sitting on its eggs. And this buck would not let anyone get near it. Just stood guard. I mean, that is empathy. And yet, I don't know if you want to say animals project in the way we do, but somehow, by our definition, that would be projection.
Perhaps they have mirror neurons.
Maybe they have mirror neurons too.
But they would, if you believe in Darwin, they would be becoming more, whatever. They would be evolving as well as we would.
The animals, yeah. So, I think at a higher rate than we are, too.
The animals over time are evolving. They are becoming more conscious.
Yeah.
That would be my thought process there.
Well, that maternal instinct, that's got activated.
Yeah. This would be saying the maternal instinct is a projection, based on a projection, but a projection which is physiologically happening. They use the word passive. I don't care about the word. Just so you know that how they try to see sympathy, empathy, whatever you want to call it, as our ability to see ourselves and the other person and say, if I were in their shoes, this is how I would be feeling, therefore I will do such and such. As I said, this is about the last time we'll hear of it, but I did want to mention it. She'll be talking about what she calls active projection of our seeing a complex of our personal or collective unconscious in the outer world or another person.
I mean, to me, then, it almost means it's conscious, if it's active, it's unconscious, if it's passive.
Or instinctual.
Yeah. I would go maybe instinctual with passive, unconscious with active. Because both are really, I don't know, don't worry about the words. I think you drive yourself nuts. You drove me nuts until Carol set me straight. I'm happy with neurons. But here's how she describes it, just to hear it. 16, the end of the first paragraph. When unconscious identity operates negatively, it causes us naively and thoughtlessly to take for granted that the other is like us and that what is valid for him is also valid. Valid for us is also valid for him. That's what you were talking about, I think, Anne. So that we feel justified in improving him, that is, in raping him psychologically. This is the origin of active projection. Passive projection down below, is unconscious empathy, is part of the psychological principle of Eros and forms the basis of all social relations. Active projection, on the other hand, belongs to the realm of Logos since it is concerned with an act of recognition. Just so you know, there are two different types. And I think we can forget about empathy because she's going to be talking about the other type pretty much in the book.
That's pretty strong, raving. Raving is a pretty strong word.
Boy, you know, the more I do this work, the more I feel that.
That's
right. I've heard it, I think, in pop psych, they call it soul murder. And how much of what collective consciousness calls goodwill is really murdering the other person? Because it assumes that I know what's right for them. My help is to help them go in a certain direction. Well, that direction is my direction. I mean, look at our foreign policy. We're helping the Middle East. See what I mean? We're just murdering them. So, not to get you out of feeling helpful, but to be aware of the hidden power principle in certain forms of goodwill.
And then it's interesting, then she links the passive into the feeling function. Whereas
yes.
Up here,
yeah.
The active will...
Yeah. I find her vocabulary confusing. So I would just say, think of empathy as based in projection as much as what we normally call projection.
It looks like she says the active is unconscious identity and then the passive is unconscious empathy.
Yeah.
That helps a little.
Yeah.
Say that again. Well, on the top part that you read about active imagination, it starts out saying an unconscious identity.
Mm-hmm.
And then down below, the paragraph on passive projection, she calls it unconscious empathy. So maybe it's the aspect of identity.
Yeah, I think we drive ourselves crazy.
Yeah, I'm with you on that one.
And yet we all know when somebody's trying to psychically murder us.
Yeah. Yeah.
You can feel that. I think that's why there's all those vampire shows on television.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. Now we switch gears a little bit. We talk about bewitching.
Talk about what you think?
Bewitching.
Oh.
Bottom of 16. We've been talking about making projections. Now we're going to be talking about being the recipient of projections. Another way to put that, which would be more amenable to common speech, but we are trying to introduce a little bit more differentiated vocabulary, is what is the effect on you of other people's expectations, and particularly with children. I recently heard a situation where a father said to his son, you know, you're irresponsible, you are not reliable, you waste money, and until you shape up, I am not paying for college. The grandparents got involved and said, there's nothing wrong with this kid. We'll pay for college. The kid is flourishing. See what I mean? That was the father's negative projection, and it can destroy people. So she'll be talking about now what's it mean to be projected. That's a negative, but I think the positive are just as destructive. Think of Janis Joplin, Jimi Hendrix, all the heroes that have been idealized just burn themselves up in the euphoria of being a hero. So either way, it can be very destructive. On the other hand, it can be positive if what you are projecting onto the other person is a realistic projection. So that you see you want your child to do the best. And that is based on your own capacity to be a healthy, productive person. But then you allow the child to do its best in the way it chooses. So that's what she's dealing with here. So bottom of 16, the projections of our fellow, here I am, beings onto ourselves are by no means harmless affairs that disturb nothing but the adaptation. Skip a little bit. The projections of parents onto their children are especially influential because children and young people are very suggestible for their ego consciousness is still weak. I think that's an incredibly important sentence. I'm tempted to say what really affects a child isn't what you say, it isn't what you do, it's what you project onto the child. Another way to put that is, it's not what you say, it's not what you do, it's your unconscious expectations of that child. And the child will become what you unconsciously expect them to become. That's why I think all this self-help of parenting, well, might be valid to a certain extent if it's not getting at the parents' fantasies of the child or the dreams of the child. It's not really getting at what shapes the child. She gives a fairy tale again. Six swans. Top of 17. The witch-like stepmother throws a garment over her stepsons, thereby transforming them into swans. This can be taken quite literally as projection. The mother, being negatively disposed to the children, sees in them, and I love this phrase, not their own human nature, but rather throws over them the projection of something's bird image existing in her, namely her own unconscious, neglected spiritual side. But behind all of this book is this question, what is our own human nature? And how can we help our loved ones develop it? And how can we make sure we are developing it? How can we watch what we are projecting onto them? And how can we discern what's being projected onto us so that the true nature of both persons can flourish. One that comes across this quite often in everyday life when a mother out of laziness or for other reasons neglects her own spiritual development. To compensate, she expects the achievement from her son or sons and bewitches them into something that is alien to their nature. The sons, for instance, may have to pursue an ambitious academic career in order to satisfy the mother's unconscious expectation. The fairy tale just mentioned, they become birds, that is, rootless, dehumanized spirit beings. I remember that was 2 years ago, this guy in my French class, really a nice guy, who wanted to study philosophy, and his parents insisted he studied law. And by the time he was 21, he had 2 DUIs. Mad as hell. But they didn't care what he wanted to do. They had their idea what he should do. The release of the bewitched beings in the fairy tale occurs when the loving sister, or sometimes the bride, sews a shirt of star-like flowers for the bewitched and throws it over them, whereby the birds once again assume human form. This too is a projection, albeit one that fits the object, which indeed actually makes it possible for him to appear in his true nature. Many people are, in fact, brought back to themselves through the loving appreciation of another person.
That's sort of a beautiful symbol of the Sophia aspect of the pattern of our faith, the star-like pattern.
And you can see how it is a projection, but it's a projection that fits. The teacher or therapist who gives credit, so to speak, to his pupil or patient through the expectation of positive results can often nurture a blossoming of the other's real personality and gifts. Perhaps it is not important that it is a projection. It operates like a bridge across which the other can come into himself. That is why the phenomenon of kind of transference is so important in psychotherapy, and not just as a disadvantage to be combated. It can carry the other like a magic carpet and guide him to his goal. One day, though, this projection naturally falls away, and then it must be proven whether the other can remain himself even without such help. Chocolate time.
Chocolate.
Get a reward for sticking with all this tough psychology.
Yeah.